the start of the pandemic crisis, the European Commission suspended the fiscal rules that apply to member states to allow countries to use fiscal policy domestically to deal with a health emergency. This suspension was further extended when Russia invaded Ukraine and caused a grave energy crisis in the European Union. The suspension is now meant to be lifted in 2024, when the rules will come back into full operation. In this three-year period, the European Commission has also made an attempt to update and modernize the fiscal framework in a proposal that it put forward last April. Here with me to evaluate this proposal are two of my colleagues, Bruegel's director Jeremy Zettelmeyer and Zsolt Darvas, a senior fellow at Bruegel. My name is Maria Demergis, and you're listening to The Sound of Economics, Bruegel's podcast series. Jeremy, you, together with Zsolt and Lena Relsol, have just released an analysis that you have put together on this Commission proposal. Tell us what the aim of the paper is.
So the Commission's proposal would differ quite radically from the existing rules, the rules that are currently in place but have not been fully applied because of the pandemic, as you stated. And one of the aims of the paper is to find out how much this would actually matter in practice for the fiscal adjustment that countries would have to undertake in the next 5 years or so. So what does this matter for the path of fiscal deficits and debt according to the new set of rules? How does it compare to the current set? Another point of the paper is to find out what is driving the fiscal adjustment obligations, if you like, of countries under the new proposed set of rules, because there are two types of devices there, if you like. There are sort of two guiding principles or two sets of guiding principles for why countries would have to adjust. One is the core of the proposal as it was first communicated by the European Commission in November. And that is the idea that country by country, you do a debt sustainability analysis. That is, you evaluate the probability that debt will explode on current policies. And you figure out a medium-term adjustment objective, so how much they should raise the balance of revenues over expenditures over a four-year, maybe up to seven-year period to avoid this from happening in the 10 years following that adjustment period, taking also into account aging costs. So this is the so-called debt sustainability analysis approach, the DSA base requirement, and also how much it would take to reduce deficits below the benchmark of 3% that is required by the treaty. So as you know, as our listeners know, many countries in the EU have now substantially larger deficits than the 3% because they're still coming out of this period where spending was quite high, first because of the pandemic, then because of the energy crisis. So we have a system that was sort of devised by the European Commission to meet these two main criteria, but because some member states were critical of this bespoke approach to fiscal adjustment. They believe that this is not transparent enough, possibly not ambitious enough. They didn't really know what would come out of this in terms of concrete debt reduction requirements. They did perhaps not fully trust the European Commission's implementation of this approach. So the bottom line is that in April, about 5 months after the Commission first came up with this idea, the legislative proposal of the Commission, so the actual law that was put forward by the Commission in draft form, incorporated not only these basic ideas, but also several additional requirements, which we refer to as safeguards in the paper. And these are essentially requirements saying, you know, no matter what the DSA says, the debt sustainability analysis, and no matter whether you need it in order to reduce your debt to 3% by the end of this adjustment period, debt must decline within the first 4 years. So this is the so-called debt safeguard. And then there are several others, which we can talk about it later. And so what we really wanted to know in this paper, apart from the overall impact of this new framework, is whether the April legislative proposal was now really driven by these new safeguards, which were put in for the sake of political compromise, or whether it still retained this bespoke, country-specific character of the original proposal.
And I presume you're looking at the consistency of these two sets of rules, I mean, and how much they matter actually in the fiscal adjustment of countries. So let's go then to the results that you find. I think this is the most important part. Does the new proposal add anything to the new fiscal rules, Zsolt?
The new proposal very much differs from the existing set of fiscal rules, which also composed of multiple rules. For example, there is a rule currently which requires that the debt ratio must decline by the so-called 1/20th of the gap to the 60% debt benchmark of the EU treaties. But this rule, whenever it was violated in the past decade, this was never enforced. Another major existing rule is the so-called structural budget balance rule. The structural budget balance is the budget balance of the government, from which the impact of the economic cycle is filtered out, because certainly in good times there are more tax revenues, in bad times there are less tax revenues. It's an indicator which is very difficult to measure, and in the current system there is a very strong emphasis on meeting targets on this so-called structural balance. So the new framework would almost completely get rid of these indicators and very much focuses on debt sustainability. But as Jérôme just said, some of these simple numerical safeguards were introduced. And what we found is that at the first application of the new system, if it would hypothetically start and hopefully start next year in 2024, if the adjustment period will last for 4 years, then these additional safeguards would have very limited role. For most countries, still, the debt sustainability analysis would determine how much fiscal adjustments countries have to do. Now, there are some exceptions, and a main exception is France, for which this so-called debt safeguard would be binding, implying that the debt ratio in 2028 must be lower than in 2024. So for all other countries, also, I would also say the other exception is Bulgaria, but Bulgaria has a very low debt, 28% of GDP. But for all countries which has public debt above 60%, this debt safeguard wouldn't really matter, but it would matter a lot for France.
Just a clarification. So when you say that these extra rules, the safeguards will bind, does this mean that France, from whom this is true, will have to make additional effort on top of what the DSA requires?
That's correct. So it's one of our main results is that the DSA requirements actually do imply substantial fiscal adjustment. Many countries with debt above 60%, right, for whom this is relevant. The rules are also relevant for countries with debts below 60%, but deficits that are higher than 3%. But, you know, we have essentially significant adjustment requirements in most countries. The main exceptions are actually Greece and Cyprus. And the reason for that is very simply that they already have adjusted a lot. So they already have substantial surpluses and a structural primary basis. So a cyclically adjusted non-interest spending, revenue minus non-interest spending. So they would not have to continue adjusting, but virtually all other countries would to a greater or lesser extent. And I think we have for the 13 or so countries with debts above 60%, 9 or so would require adjustments of more than 2% of GDP between 2024 and 2028 on top of what the European Commission is already projecting they will adjust in the next 2 years. So this is quite substantial.
As a result of imposing the safeguard, or is it just on the DSA?
This is the overall result of the framework.
Okay.
And as Jolt said, if you look at a four-year horizon, adjustment horizon, the safeguard is virtually never binding. The big exception is France. Now, if France is giving 4 years to adjust, then according to our results, if you disregard this debt safeguards, they would need to adjust it about 0.8 points of GDP per year on average, which is already very high. I mean, it is quite demanding. If then you put the debt safeguard on top, this goes up to 1.1 percent of GDP, which is very difficult to imagine that this would happen. And certainly, at, you know, the economic costs of this would be quite high. Now, it is worth just explaining why France is an outlier in this respect. And so basically, it's the combination of three factors. The first is France has a very large deficit currently, and it's projected to remain quite large. So I think the Commission projects it to remain over 4% in 2024, I think 4.3 or so percent in 2024. And so if you start with such a big deficit, then even if you reduce it quite fast, you're still borrowing money, right? And during this period, if you borrow money at a faster rate than you're growing, then your debt might continue to go up. The second important point is that the requirement for France based on debt sustainability analysis is somewhat less onerous than for other countries with its debt level. And the reasons is that there's some fundamentals of France that actually look quite good in the long term. And so the most important ones are that France is projected to pay a low interest rate on its debt, lower than its potential growth rate in the long run. So the famous R minus G, the long real interest rate is projected to be below the long growth rate. So that helps bring the debt down. And then the other very important point is that France has a relatively favorable demographic projection. And so, as I mentioned at the beginning, you know, one idea behind this new proposal is that this medium-term adjustment objective has to be defined at a level where a country in effect pre-funds increases in the fiscal costs of aging that are projected for the next 10 years. But France is one of the few countries where actually the aging costs, fiscal aging costs, are projected to start declining within the next 10 years. So that makes it relatively unique. And so basically the debt sustainability analysis says, well, sure, they have a large deficit, but actually to make the debt sustainable, you don't require such a huge adjustment because their long-term outlook looks quite good. The other things that might be driving down the debt are relatively powerful. And then the third thing that operates plays an important role for France is essentially an idiosyncrasy of the way in which the European Commission makes, or not just the Commission, the EU applies a common methodology for projecting growth over the medium term. And this turns out to produce a very low number for France. So over the medium term, France is not projected to grow a whole lot, and that makes it harder to comply with this debt safeguard that says the debt ratio, the ratio between, you know, euro debt and nominal GDP should come down in the first 4 years. And so you have this result that in order to meet with the debt safeguard, France would have to do an even bigger adjustment than it already is prescribed by the debt sustainability analysis.
So the safeguards actually make then only difference for France and Bulgaria, if I understand correctly. But do you think that then they add extra safety into the system when it comes to France? Do they make a material difference?
No. I don't know whether Jolt has a different view on this. I mean, the Bulgaria result is in any case a quirk. In our view, this is just poor drafting.
But that's because of the debt being much lower than 60%. Of course, it's no issue.
Yes. I mean, Bulgaria has one of the lowest debt ratios of the EU. They do have a very large deficit, but still, you know, the debt safeguard should not apply to countries with debts of less than 60% of GDP. It goes against the spirit of the treaty. You cannot force debt to go even lower. And in fact, the European Commission staff told us that when they apply the new methodology, they will essentially ignore those cases. But this is not in the regulation, right? Yeah. So we still looked at this. But, you know, the point for a case like France is that I think the way I would justify these debt safeguards is that, you know, unless you're worried about cheating in the implementation of the debt sustainability analysis itself, which clearly some countries are, but which we think should be addressed in a different way, and we can talk about that by making the methodology transparent, agreeing on a common methodology, and so forth. So unless you're worried about this cheating, the only thing that really justifies something like a debt safeguard is this notion that unless you require debt to come down relatively quickly, countries will not really get going in the debt reduction, right? That they will procrastinate. But there's a better way to do it, which in theory is also part of the new framework, which is a so-called no backloading safeguard, which says whatever your medium-term debt reduction objective is, don't wait until the last year of your four-year or your seven-year adjustment period to start with the adjustment, but spread it out evenly over that adjustment period. So that condition, I think, is justified, even though it does restrict flexibility, because it addresses a serious issue, which is procrastination. But the big difference between this type of condition and the debt safeguard is that a no backloading condition does not interfere. It does not second guess the medium-term adjustment objective that pops out of the debt sustainability analysis. It takes that as a given and then says, now, with that being the right number, say a country has to do another 2% of adjustment, spread it out evenly. It doesn't say, oh, debt needs to be lower than at the beginning, so you don't need to do 2% of adjustment, you actually need to do 4% of adjustment, right? Which I think is not justified and really undermines one of the main purposes of this methodology, which is to have something that is more tailored to country circumstances and, as a result, causes less resistance in those countries, and which are countries are just more willing to comply with.
Zsolt, something to add?
One of the main problems, I think, of the existing fiscal framework was indeed that countries simply don't really internalize or didn't feel an ownership about the fiscal rules. Also, in many cases, it was a lot of, you know, nitty-gritty details that they, you know, discussed with the Commission on month-to-month. It was reported in the media that the deficit should be 2.1 or 2.2% and so on. So basically, countries, I would say, broadly complied, I mean, whenever they could. So, I mean, the budget deficit was not 10%. But they always wanted to do, you know, just the minimum to avoid any punishment. And they always had, you know, the hope that even if they end up in a so-called excessive deficit procedure, you know, which is the European Union procedure for countries with having large budget deficits or high and not sufficiently declining public debts. So they were hoping that, you know, other ministers at the meeting will eventually conclude that, oh, okay, I mean, we don't punish you because, you know, 5 years from now you might judge me, so I don't want to judge you. So clearly, I think that the major new benefit of this framework, major benefit of this new framework would indeed that countries can feel a kind of ownership, that they understand the rationale behind that. Because everybody understands, even an ordinary politician understands that, you know, the debt, if it's very high, it has to decline. And if they understand that this is the logic of the new methodology, and the goal is not to interfere with national fiscal policy decisions on what taxes to raise or what expenditures to cut, then there is a much bigger chance that countries indeed will comply. And the risk is that if there are many safeguards which are not neutral or not, you know, directly derived from the framework, that might undermine this ownership feeling.
Let me just dwell on this point, because it seems to me that this seeking accountability, which is of course very desirable, and ownership, as you call it, might come at the expense of simplicity. Don't you think that the rules have become complicated for countries to be able to implement them?
Current rules are overly complicated.
Yeah. Are they any simpler as a result of both April and November?
So the new rules, I think, very simple, but the implementation is complex. Because the underlying principle that the public debt ratio, if it's above 60% of GDP, has to decline, even under adverse scenarios, like, you know, lower growth or higher interest rates or a lower budget deficit, which can, you know, happen. So this is the principle is, I think, is very, very simple.
Yeah.
Now, what is complicated is, or not complicated, but what requires a lot of technical expertise and careful thinking is actually how to do these projections.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in fact, one of our mere suggestions in the paper, that even though the methodology which is used by the commission is very much in line with the standard practice of the literature, both academic literature and what other institutions like the IMF or the European Stability Mechanism use, there would be a lot of room for improvement. And within this improvement, an ownership could be built even hopefully by those countries that are currently a bit, you know, I mean, adverse or skeptical about the usefulness of debt sustainability analysis.
Yeah, so the debt sustainability analysis is at the core of what you like about the new rules, right?
Yes. So it's also important in answering your question, are the, these new rules even more complicated than the old ones? It's also important to distinguish the core intellectual piece of these new rules.
Yeah.
And all the stuff that has now been packed onto them to reassure some member states that are worried about abuse of the DSA. So indeed, if you read sort of the new rules, you know, this is Annex 1 of the regulation that would replace the preventive arm of the stability and growth pacts, and there are 6 conditions, right? So 6 is quite a big number of conditions. Now, of these 6 conditions, 3 are these add-ons to reassure the fiscally conservative countries, some of them, that the debt sustainability analysis could not be easily abused.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, these conditions contradict some of the implications of the debt sustainability analysis. Now, if you strip those extra safeguards out, you set them aside, and you focus on the 3 main things that come out of the Commission's proposal, they are very simple to summarize and explain. And so, one of them is a rule, and the other 2 is what I would call a standard. And it's not, which is not very made very precise in numbers in that regulation. But the reason is that the world is complex, and making it precise does then require a more elaborate methodology, which is described separately. And, you know, that's a methodology that has not been very transparent, and this is one of the problems of the proposal, but which we, with our paper, are trying to make more transparent. So our paper describes in detail what this methodology is, and to the point where we will publish the computer code that drives this methodology, and it's replicable then by everyone. But in any case, the basic principles of the new methodology are very simple. So there's one rule which says that by the end of this adjustment period of 4 to 7 years, the deficit must be back down below 3%. Okay, that's a very easy one. Then there is the DSA requirement, debt sustainability analysis requirement, that says that after the end of the adjustment period, debt must be put on a downward trajectory such that it is very unlikely that as a result of bad shocks, debt will explode, right? That is the basic idea. So it must be a downward trajectory, but also one that will materialize with high probability. And then, you know, there is an elaboration in the methodology underlies that of what that means. And so this is about stress tests. You know, stress tests is a very standard tool that is routinely used in financial stability. And so there's this stress test idea is being applied to making sure that debt really falls down. And then there's also a probabilistic analysis where they actually put a number on what it means, you know, with 70% probability. Debt has to fall. That's in the sense that it's lower. 5 years after the end of the adjustment period relative to what it is at the beginning of the adjustment period. So I would call that a standard, not a rule, because there is no numerical simple target. But it makes a lot of sense. Debt must robustly decline. And then the third rule or standard is this idea that you should not wait too long with the adjustment, yeah, within the adjustment period. We have a criticism of that because it's actually very poorly drafted. It doesn't actually restrict much. But again, the main idea is very simple to explain. So I think these, the main ideas are very simple. Then the implementations of the ideas are complicated. But the reason for that is that the world is complicated. And by trying to simplify this, you're not gaining anything.
Yeah, so by making it tailor-made, everything that is considered here makes it much more tailor-made to the countries. But agreeing on some of the assumptions that are going in such that the methodology can be implemented isn't necessarily going to be an easy thing, right?
That's correct. And I mean, here also, we maybe slightly disagree with the Commission proposal. So the way the Commission proposal is drafted is we, the Commission, use our own methodology. And member states have no business telling us what to do. And we will base our own surveillance on our own methodology, which we have laid out in some degree in the Debt Sustainability Monitor, which is a document the Commission produces every year. But, you know, it's not complete enough to really make you understand what they do, right? Hopefully with our paper, it will be clearer. But then the Commission reserves the right to change its methodology whenever it wants. So it wants, the methodology itself is very, very briefly, cursorily described in an annex to the regulation. And the Commission proposes that they can change this annex without going back and asking member states or the parliament. It's a so-called delegated power. So that's sort of on the one hand. And then on the other hand, the Commission says, well, but you member states, when you come up with your own plans, you know, based on our so-called technical trajectory. So we give you our ideas, the Commission's ideas on how fast debt should be declining and what this means for your expenditure and revenues. But then you, member states, come back to us with a plan of your own. And here, you know, the regulation says you have to use debt sustainability analysis and you have to make sure that a deficit is below 3% at the end of the adjustment period. But we are not particularly telling you what goes into your analysis, right? And so there is a risk here, indeed, that there will be a bit of a free-for-all. The Commission will do its thing, which member states don't understand. Member states will do their own thing, which maybe methodology could be completely different. And in the end, you know, they will give you wildly different results. And then they're going to slug it out in front of the Council and come up with some compromise. So with this sort of vision, I can understand the concerns of some of the more fiscally conservative member states that said, we'd rather have a stronger guidance for the Council in deciding who is right here. So, you know, forget this DSA stuff. Let's have the simple rules. We would just solve this problem in a different way. And the way we would solve this problem is by having member states and Commission agree on a common methodology. And the main argument why that we were told.
Methodology and assumptions or just methodology?
Yes, methodology and assumptions, except we would allow disagreements on economic projections. So what we think is that the method should be identical, but the growth projections in particular that you feed into the model, yeah, could differ between Commission and member states. And the reason for that is that member states may have, for example, particular reforms in mind, yeah, sure, that are not yet internalized by the Commission, right? So we think there should be a healthy discussion along these DSAs, but they should not get hung up on technical assumptions. They should get hung up on economic substance. And so we would rather get all this disagreement on, oh, we don't like you the way you do your DSA, we do it differently. We want to get this out of the way before the method really comes into effect. And as far as I can see, the only argument against doing this is that if we open up this methodology can of worms, it may take countries 10 years with the Commission to agree on a methodology. And so what we propose is that the law is put into effect with an annex that says, now, in principle, we agree. This is on all the building blocks of the new system, but the actual technical assumptions underlying the methodology should be reviewed. And then there should be a relatively tight timetable for doing this, maybe like 12 months. I think key to making this happen without this whole thing getting stuck is to have an independent expert commission that takes the lead.
Ah, okay. No, I was coming to that. The arbitrator of last resort.
Yes. I mean, there should be some expert commission that takes the lead on the technical side, but of course, with the requirement to seek the views of the commission, seek the views of the member state, the commission methodology, I think, should be the point of departure for this, because it's a good methodology. The methodology is fine. They make some, you know, assumptions that are worth discussing. They simplify maybe a little too much at various things. So we have an annex in our paper. We explain these things, but basically the architecture of the methodology is okay. But you need a discussion about it for member states to buy into this, right? And so it would be nice if a neutral body took the first step in a technical sense and then and heard everyone, including also the ECB, the ESM, the European Fiscal Board, and then the result would be a report, and that report could then be endorsed by the Council.
That very nicely brings me to one thing I don't think that you have in the paper, which is the political economy aspects of this, right? So suppose you have this there's issues that are interesting to think about, and that is now beyond a little bit the paper, right? But the referee of last resort, as it were, and you know the validity, the accountability of this, I mean, all of these things play a very big role in decision making in Europe, and you know, if it were to come to disagreements, who would have the last word? And importantly, in the previous set of rules that we had, the ones that are suspended, we had ways of having enforcement that, as you have said at the beginning, so it was not very well enforced. That's why we needed new rules. But we also had punishments. How would the new world in a system that is, as Jeremy just described, how would that play out? Would there be what is the punishment if it were not to work?
The major goal of the new system is that countries would agree with it, internalize in their own decision making, and then as a result there will be no need for a punishment. This is the ideal world that we all hope for, and certainly I see a greater chance for this to happen with the new framework than with the existing framework. But nevertheless, there are, I mean, also the Commission envisions, of course, some punishments.
Repercussions. Let's call them repercussions.
I mean, I'm very much against financial sanctions, I have to say, in EU fiscal rules. It did not work in the past. Now we need to see whether they would work in the future. But the way the Commission plans to do that is that sanctions would come much earlier in the process and in much smaller steps. Because in the past, you know, lots of procedures have to be passed and then, you know, 0.5% of GDP sanctions, fines could be imposed. Now it planned to be, I mean, the total amount would not exceed 0.5% this time as well, but sanctions would come earlier. Another disciplining device is that the European Central Bank has a market instrument which is called Transmission Protection Instrument, by which the European Central Bank can intervene in government bond markets whenever there is a major pressure on the market, which is, in their language, is called dysfunctional market developments push the interest rate of a country to a much higher level. And the ECB set some conditions, some eligibility conditions for this TPI instrument. And one of the conditions is that countries have to abide by the fiscal rules. So again, you know, countries with high debt, which sometimes in the past experience major pressures on the government bond markets, they may think twice. Look, I mean, if I comply with the fiscal rules, then the ECB can easily intervene if there would be an undue pressure on markets. which I think can also be an important disciplining factors that countries will likely consider.
Yeah, Jeroen?
So for me, it's really important to distinguish conceptually between enforcement and compliance. And these two terms are constantly confused. So enforcement is the stick that you wield if countries don't behave. Compliance is the result, the actual behavior, taking into account all aspects of the framework, including enforcement, but not limited to enforcement. The fundamental insight that we need to, I think, all understand and agree with, based on, you know, several decades of experience with this fiscal framework, is that enforcement is always going to be weak. And it's weak by design, because Article 126 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union explicitly takes off the table the normal enforcement mechanism of the European Treaty, which is a legal avenue that goes all the way to the European Court of Justice, the so-called treaty infringement procedure. This explicitly does not apply to the fiscal area. And so, you know, all these substitute mechanisms for enforcement, peer pressure, reputation, and of course sanctions, they are very, very weak substitutes. And even though the Commission makes yet another attempt in this fiscal framework to kind of fine-tune this enforcement a little bit, we know it's not very strong. On the other hand, it's not completely negligible either. So, you know, clearly countries, even with, you know, rather dumb rules in the past, have tried to somewhat comply because they were worried about some degree of enforcement, right? And so the way I interpret this framework is that they essentially, then there is no path-breaking idea here to fundamentally improve enforcement. I mean, there is this, you know, tinkering around the edges with smaller punishments earlier and stuff, but fundamentally the enforcement mechanism is going to be unchanged relative to the current rules. What they aim at is, given this very limited enforcement, they would want to improve compliance. Why? By making the rules more reasonable, right? By micromanaging countries less. And this is why this idea to add all these safeguards on that, which contradict the main device which makes these new rules more reasonable, namely that this is going to be a bespoke plan for you that takes all the country specificities of your country into account, is completely counterproductive. So these safeguards are killing the one thing that may actually improve compliance in the new system over the old system. That is, I think, one of the reasons why I'm opposed to them.
Okay, that's a very good point, actually, the difference between enforcement and compliance. We can't do much about enforcement. Let's do something about compliance, right? And that's bound to be an improvement, you mean, right? Okay, I'm also looking at the time. I think they have one more question for you, and I think that's, again, beyond the scope of the paper, but it fits very much into the effort to deal with, you know, the fiscal efforts that we're going to have to make as soon as the rules come back into effect. And that is that we are actually reigniting the rules at a time when we are almost at the bottom of the business cycle. And I wanted also to pick your brains on how you feel about that, because, you know, the fiscal adjustment is going to sort of speed up, given 3 years of huge fiscal, the use of the fiscal instrument, and now without rules, but now with rules. How do you feel about reactivating the rules at a time when actually we might need it the most?
So let me offer three reactions. The first one is that the treaty defines the 60% public debt and the 3% budget deficit as a requirement. And I think nobody realistically believes that the treaty can be changed. So we are in an ideal world. These numerical benchmarks could be removed, and a fiscal framework could be designed, which is conducive both for fiscal sustainability and cyclical support of the economy. But given this legal constraint, we are looking for second best solutions. given the 60% and the 3%, which is in the treaty, how to design a fiscal framework which does the least harm, I would say, when cyclical conditions go down. And I think the current framework, again, if we can take aside all of these safeguards.
You don't mean the current framework. You mean the proposed framework.
The proposed framework, if we take aside all of the safeguards, does a relatively good job there. So this is my first point. My second point is that there is a major uncertainty of what's coming up. I mean, if you look at ECB calculations, they believe that there's a 40% probability of a recession by the end of 2025. We did a similar calculation in one of our other papers and came to similar numbers. So certainly there's a major uncertainty of what's coming up. Nevertheless, the baseline outlook is not that bleak. I mean, for the Eurozone, I mean, the ECB just published a few days ago its recent forecast, and I mean it expects 1.5% growth returning, which is not high, but certainly not something super low. So I think until we are on the baseline growth path, then I think this fiscal consolidation will go on. Mm-hmm. And you know, the main question is if growth will disappoint seriously, then whether there is also so-called escape clauses in the current framework, which allows, you know, different adjustment or even suspending the rules again if very bad shocks hit the economy. So we need to see whether these big shocks or very adverse shocks would come and how deep the recession would be. That's my second one. But my third point is that there's another aspect I would like to bring in. And that's the green transition and the public funding for green transition, and an issue at Bruegel we have very long been writing about. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, countries not just need to consolidate their budgets, reducing their budget deficits, but at the same time, they also have to increase spending on green priorities, also on defense and on some other priorities. And I mean, as we concluded, you know, the current framework, or so the proposed new framework, still foresees a relatively ambitious adjustment path. And it's very hard to see how the countries would do an even bigger adjustment, I would say, to all expenditures other than climate, so that they can increase climate spending. Mm-hmm. I think it's very unlikely to happen. So what he also suggested in our paper, that there should be at least a temporary exception for climate-related and possibly other related investments, which are very specific, and we don't want to give a blanket exemption, but very specific investments which are very much in line with EU priorities and, importantly, endorsed by the council. So the council can say, look, if you do this, climate measure, then you can exempt it.
You mean like a green golden rule, that type of thing? The equivalent of?
Something like that, but we propose only temporarily. So what we suggest is that during the adjustment period, there can be a temporary deviation.
An investment push that raises the debt
threshold.
Well, the fundamental constraint that after 4 years, you need to be at your target structural primary balance, which is substantially higher from what it is now, would not be affected. But what you can do is you can raise investment in the meantime, and then you take it off at the end.
You're a temporary bump then?
That's right. There would be a bump. There would be debt finance investment, but the medium-term deficit would not go up because it is temporary.
But between the two, you need an even higher fiscal effort, right? Between the top of the bump and your target, you need that extra effort, right?
No. So temporarily, you would, if you have a good investment plan, so this would be EU-endorsed, council-endorsed, you can do a debt financing within your adjustment period, whether this is 4 years or 7 years. So if you have a seven-year adjustment period, which is something that is possible under the new rules, if you have strong plans for growth inducing investment and reform, and then you want to layer, say, a climate related investment program on top, then in principle, you can, without really changing the fundamental operation of your system, you can do an adjustment of the ongoing annual deficit, abstracting from the extra investment, and you raise then the fiscal balance to the desired target by the end of those 7 years. But within those 7 years, you could also have purely debt-financed investment, no additional effort required, so long as you take it off at the end, so you arrive at the deficit that you have targeted. Now, in order to do that, of course, you cannot have a debt safeguard over those 7 years, or you would have to modify the debt safeguard to, in effect, take out the debt that was caused by this investment finance, right? But what we are not arguing for in this paper is to take out that extra, say, climate-related debt out of the debt sustainability analysis, right? So you would, in the end, have to pay down that debt, right? And that will somewhat increase your structurally primary balance target at the end. But what we do not want is sort of all these artificial constraints that prevent you from doing the right thing, which is, you know, you raise public investment, but you do it in a fiscal responsible way, meaning that you adjust at the same time so that then at the end you can repay this, right? That should be possible.
Provided it doesn't compromise your debt sustainability analysis.
Exactly. Exactly. That is still overriding. So there's no argument here to sort of disregard this debt or anything like that, right? So only for the purposes of the application of the safeguards, we think it should be taken out.
Any other issues on this? How do you feel about introducing the rules right at the time that it might be more difficult to do so?
So I'm also worried that we are going to see central banks, and particularly the ECB, on the one hand, succeed in bringing inflation down, and at the same time, possibly at the cost of a recession, which might get a lot worse because everyone is slamming on the fiscal brakes at the same time.
At higher interest rates as well.
That's right. So that is a serious worry, and we expressed this worry in a companion paper to the one that we're discussing today that we wrote for the European Parliament. At the same time, I also think that there is probably, you know, you cannot use this argument to completely put off fiscal adjustment. I mean, it's not necessarily a flaw of the system. It is a fact of life that, you know, objectives conflict. And so reducing debt will require some period of fiscal consolidation. And so this has cyclical risks. What we need is enough flexibility to do the consolidation in the sense that it doesn't drive the economy to the ground. And, you know, under the new system, I think we would have that, particularly if you can spread the adjustment over 7 years. And so here, one of the really important things about this debt safeguard is that it would actually prevent you from doing that. So that's another reason to get rid of that. So I think sort of the combination of 7-year adjustment in countries with a good reform program, so you make the adjustment quite gradual, plus a supportive ECB that once it has reached the inflation target could then lower interest rates again and sort of in that sense help the fiscal authorities, right? So I can see a way in which this can be pulled off, but there are also very big risks.
Putting in the monetary policy even complicates the things even further. First, we need to get the target before we can start reducing interest rates, but okay. Well, thank you both very much. I hope we can get into a set of rules by 2024 that increase the compliance, since we know we can't really improve on the enforcement. But that's all we have time for today. Thank you both very much for coming, and I advise our listeners to read the paper, which is on our website together with all our publications, www.bruegel.org. Thank you very much, and see you next time. Bye-bye.